Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends that they'll deliver discreetly right to your doorstep. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. It is wild how different each one of their gummies feels. Their sleepy time gummies knock me out in about 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I just wake up feeling amazing. Oh, and the Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right and you just need to hit the reset button on your crap mood. What makes these different is how they pair THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're not going to just find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. And they have gummies for literally everything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, and sexual arousal. And each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, Listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
Hey there, Rainbow Warriors. I'm CJ, host of Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBT. My episodes focus on crimes committed by and against the LGBTQ community. I've covered cases you probably have heard of, such as Matthew Shepard, Brandon Tina, and the Orlando Pulse nightclub massacre, as well as some lesser-known cases like the murder of Ray Hainish, the Australian Gay Beat murders, and the suspicious disappearance of Lisa Lynn Stone. I cover cases brought to me by listeners like Penny Brummer, who I believe was wrongfully convicted, taboo cases such as lesbian corrective rape and murder in South Africa, and Pray the Gay Away camps. I discuss gay serial killers, women who pretend to be men to hook up with other women, and trans murders. I'm opinionated and uncensored. I know I'm not everyone's cup of tea, but surely I'm someone's shot at tequila. No matter what your gender or orientation in life might be, please join me as I tackle rainbow crimes in search of unicorn justice. Remember, it's not a crime to be gay, unless you're a murderer.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
Jennifer Kessie was in love. She and her boyfriend, Rob Allen, had been together for over a year, and even though it was long distance, they were making it work. They had just come back from a weekend getaway in St. Croix, and Jennifer was returning to a home in Orlando, Florida that she had just bought for herself and a job that she loved. But on Tuesday, January 24th, 2006, Jennifer didn't show up for work. Though her car was later found, Jennifer was not. But now, 16 years later, her parents, who have been searching for her relentlessly, believe that they're closer than ever to getting answers. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Jennifer Kessie. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. Jennifer Kessie has been back in the news recently because it was just the 16th anniversary of her disappearance a few weeks before we're recording this. Her family, as I mentioned, is still actively leading searches for her without any help from law enforcement. So even though this is a relatively well-known case, I figured a signal boost could never hurt. But before we get started, we'd like to take just a moment to thank the lovely folks who have joined us over on Patreon. So thank you very much, Lindsay S., Katie, and Ashley P.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
If you would like to join and get these episodes early and ad-free, along with Ethan's show about mental health, you can do so at patreon.com/ATTWGpod. But now let's get to the story of Jennifer Kessie. Jennifer Joyce Kessie was born on May 20th, 1981 in New Jersey to Drew and Joyce Kessie. She's the oldest of two children. Her brother Logan is 3 years younger. The Kessie family eventually moved down south and settled in the Tampa, Florida area. Jennifer graduated from Vivian Gaither High School in Tampa before heading a few hours away to attend college at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. After graduation, Jennifer got a job as a finance manager for a timeshare company. She quickly moved up the ranks and had actually just gotten a promotion in 2006.
Two promotions within a year allowed Jennifer to buy her first home at the end of 2005, a condo in Mosaic at Millennia, which bills itself as a luxury condo community. So basically, Jennifer had her life together way, way more than especially me, but more than either of us did.
Yeah, me too. I mean, good Lord. How old? You said she's 24?
24.
Yeah, I don't even remember what the hell I was doing at 24.
Probably getting married.
All right. You might be right.
Yeah. Didn't own a house yet, though.
No. Still living in an apartment.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of 2005, Jennifer met Rob Allen. Rob, who lived in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, which is about 3 hours south of Orlando, was in town attending a trade show with his roommate. Like anyone who travels for a trade show, he and his friends went out to some bars afterwards. It was there that they met Jen, who was out with her friends. The two hit it off and decided to keep in touch. Rob told Dateline, quote, "It just blossomed from there," end quote. At the beginning, most of the contact was through phone calls, but they would talk multiple times per day, sometimes for hours. Soon, they decided to take the relationship to the next level, and Rob and Jen traveled back and forth to see each other whenever they could.
3 hours away?
Yeah.
That's a good distance. That's a good hike.
Yeah, it's just far enough that it's a pain in the ass for a weekend trip.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say that. It's not an easy thing to do for just a couple of days.
Yeah, yeah. Just long enough to be annoying. But they would also take vacation time and travel elsewhere together as much as possible. In January of 2006, the couple traveled to St. Croix for the weekend. They flew out of Fort Lauderdale, and when they returned on Sunday, January 22nd, Jen just decided to stay at Rob's place. She had to work the next morning, though, on Monday, so she got up super early and drove the 2.5 hours to her office in Ocoee, Florida.
That's a terrible commute.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely awful. That evening after work was the first time Jen was back at her condo since the trip. Now, other than this terrible early morning drive, it was a pretty average day. The Kessie family describes themselves as very close-knit, and Jen talked to each of her parents and her brother over the course of the day. Yeah, they are definitely the type of people they talk every day. And because she was in St. Croix, and this is 2006, and cell phones weren't what they were, I'm sure that they didn't speak at all, while she was there for the weekend.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so when she got back, it was probably just floodgates, you know?
Yeah, how was your trip?
Yeah, talking to everybody about everything.
Yeah.
And yeah, all three of them said that Jen was happy, and they just, talked about her trip and things like that. Jen's last phone call of the evening was to Rob, and that phone call was around 10 p.m. But that call didn't go as well. The pair had been dating for about a year at this point, and although 3 hours isn't a huge distance, like we said, it's just long enough.
Yeah, and I'm sure it wears on them.
Well, exactly, and it was. And so add that to the fact that they had just spent this amazing weekend together, and she was obviously exhausted because she'd been up forever and she had worked all day and driven. I don't know, Jen. I don't know how she is. I'm projecting here, but you know how I am after I get tired and, maybe our conversations aren't the best. But in any case, she was looking for reassurance that they were going to be moving forward in their relationship. She wanted to know that he loved her and that they had a future and that this stupid commuting back and forth was going to end at some point, basically. But, again, tempers were a little short. It just wasn't the greatest conversation. So it wasn't a fight or anything like that, but it wasn't the best phone call either. They were just kind of snippy with each other.
Well, I'm sure that they were both probably tired from the travel.
Right. So when they hung up, it was just more of a look, I'm tired. We don't need to talk about this right now. Let's just go to bed kind of thing. So Rob went to bed, fully expecting to hear from Jen, just like he did every morning. She usually woke up first, so she would always call or text him before she went to work. So basically, when Rob would wake up, he would have, usually a text waiting for him.
Mm-hmm.
That morning, the morning of January 24th, Rob overslept again, exhausted, I'm sure. When he woke up in a panic and was rushing to get ready for work, though, there wasn't anything from his girlfriend on his phone.
Now, do we have any way to corroborate that he was at his place that night?
Yes. All of that has been checked into.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
So this was definitely out of character for Jen because, you know, she was very consistent and very much a person who it was in touch at all times. But, you know, at this point, like, he's just more focused on getting to work. He called her on his way in, but he got her voicemail. Rob had a 9 a.m. meeting that morning and called Jen again after that was over. He wanted to tell her about something that had just happened in the meeting because what he was telling Dateline, like, she was just a really good sounding board and, you know, she was just the person that he wanted to tell things to. And that was normal. Like, they talked multiple times a day. So, you know, it was totally normal for him to call her after the meeting. What was not normal was the fact that he still could not reach her. So as the morning goes on, he starts sending her texts as well, but still no response. Now, I don't know if at this point Rob thought that maybe Jen was like more pissed at him than he had thought or what. But when he still hadn't heard from her by lunchtime, he started to get worried. He didn't just assume that she was giving him the silent treatment or the cold shoulder or anything like that, because that's just not the type of person she was. And again, like, it hadn't even really been a fight. It was just a snippy conversation.
Right.
Rob told Dateline in that interview I mentioned, quote, "It was odd that she hadn't called me back. Something wasn't right. But at first, I didn't think anything bad, like really bad, had happened to her. My mind just didn't go there. You never think something like this could ever happen to someone you love," end quote. While it took Rob until lunchtime to really start to get worried, it didn't take her coworkers nearly that long. After all, Jennifer had been with the company for 4 years at that point. She basically drove straight from Lake St. Croix the day before and still got to work on time. So when she didn't show up for an important meeting on Tuesday morning, her boss and her coworkers immediately thought that something was wrong. Like Rob, they tried calling repeatedly but got no answer. By 11 a.m., when they still couldn't reach her, her boss was ready to sound the alarm. Luckily, he knew Jennifer's parents, so he called them. Drew and Joyce, of course, immediately started calling their daughter as well. In that same Dateline interview, Drew said, quote, "I called and I called, and for the first time since Jen was a teenager, it went straight to voicemail. In that second, I knew something was wrong," end quote.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty profound right there. The fact that, you know, he can't recall a time where she didn't pick up the phone from the time she was a teenager until now.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, why it's so important, like, to pay attention to how people normally communicate.
Right, patterns.
Exactly, yeah. And they knew, like, they knew immediately that this was not okay. It's just like, I don't know if you saw this in the news. There was recently an 80-year-old woman who posted her Wordle scores every morning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and her family member saw that she hadn't posted them and got worried and checked in on her, and she was being held hostage.
What?
Yeah, no, it's a bonkers story. Like, it's completely insane. But it's the same type of thing. Like, you've got to pay attention to people's patterns. And if they aren't doing what they normally do, you need to look into why. So yeah, the Kessie family immediately sprang into action. Drew and Joyce called Logan, their son, who was at the gym, and told him what was going on. So they went and picked him up, and the three of them headed to Orlando. On the way, Drew called the condo's building manager and asked him to see if Jen's car was there. She drove a black Chevy Malibu. He confirmed that the car was gone. Keep in mind, so the Kessie family lives in Tampa, so it's about 2 hours away from Orlando. So that's why he's trying to, like, he's so concerned that he doesn't even want to wait the 2 hours to get answers. Like, he wants people to go check on her now. Drew then gave the manager permission to use their master key to get into her apartment and check to make sure that everything is okay. In this case, like, yes, I get it. That's obviously good. But it did kind of make me wonder about the legality of that. Because Jen's an adult, she owns the property on her own. Like, it's interesting to me that, like, some random guy, I mean, I don't know that
like, how did they really know that it was her dad? Could just be like, oh yeah, go into her apartment. I don't know.
Well, yeah. So I don't know as far as, I don't know obviously about the relationship that they had or whether the property manager knew him or not, but family members can give permission to enter houses.
Well, to police, but I don't know. It just seemed a little weird that, like, at this point, law enforcement was involved, and he's like, oh, yeah, I'll just go into her condo.
Well, I mean, I would agree. I think that given that same scenario, I would have probably called the police.
Yeah.
But maybe he knew the...
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's, you know, it's not important, but... So the manager and another employee went into Jennifer's condo and took a look around. Everything looked completely normal. Nothing was out of place. Her suitcase was actually still in the hallway, still packed from her trip to St. Croix. The only mess in the condo was in the bathroom, but it wasn't like an alarming mess. It was just like normal getting ready for work mess. Like there was a towel out, her blow dryer was on the sink, you know, just stuff like makeup. She had some clothes like thrown on her bed, just normal things like that. It looked like the condo of a woman who had gotten ready for work and then left. And to that point, her purse, her keys, cell phone, and her iPod were all missing. And these are the things that she took with her to work every day. So, you know, it made sense. And obviously, it actually would have been more alarming if any of those items were still there.
Right, yeah.
Because there's no sign of Jennifer or her car at this point. The Kesseys were also in contact with Rob during all this, and so he started the drive up to Orlando from Fort Lauderdale. He told Dateline that he was talking to his dad on the way up, and his dad was like, you know you're going to be the main suspect, right?
Well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and Rob was like, yeah, no, I know. Like, yeah, but I'm still going to go up, and like I've still got to go, and I've still got to get into this because she's my girlfriend, and no one can find her.
Right.
But luckily for him, and this kind of goes back to your question, you know, Rob had been in Fort Lauderdale and it ended up being pretty easy to prove that, you know, between phone records and all of that other stuff. Police, of course, did look into them as well as Jennifer's family because you have to. I mean, those are the first people you right, have yeah, to look at.
Closest people you have to.
Yeah. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be one of them.
Right.
But they were all cleared pretty quickly. And it did help, again, that none of them lived in Orlando.
Yeah, well, exactly.
You know? Yeah. So luckily, the investigation didn't waste a lot of time on that. You know, they were able to kind of point outwards very quickly. In that same Dateline interview, Rob actually said something that I thought was really touching. He was talking about how Jen's family never suspected that he did anything to her. And he said, quote, the Kessy family treated me like a son. They still do, end quote. So like that's sweet and slash heartbreaking enough, but listen to what Drew said. Quote, Rob was so supportive then and continues to be supportive. He was so brokenhearted. He gave his life searching for her as much as we did. He's part of our family and always will be, end quote. So like they just all seem like very good people. Everyone dropped everything to find Jen. Her parents stayed at her condo for months, and Rob even camped out on the couch for weeks so they could all be there to work to find her. And, you know, from the very beginning, Drew Kessy in particular really worked to get as much media attention on his daughter's case as possible. Like, he's out giving interviews. He's, like, doing everything that he can.
Good, and that's needed.
Yeah. With all of the people who are close to her kind of ruled out, like, who does that leave? What happened to Jen? Based on the fact that the apartment looked like she had gotten ready for work and left as normal, her family and police believe that she was abducted on her way there. When Jennifer moved into Mosaic at Millennia, the complex was actually still under construction and was only about half finished. So there were a ton of contractors and other workers all over the complex. In fact, they had even been working on the condo directly across the hall from her.
Mm. Witnesses and potential suspects.
Mm-hmm. As they were working, the management company allowed some of the workers to actually live in the empty condos.
What? Really?
Yeah. And this isn't something that I've ever heard of before.
No.
But yeah, and so that piece of information was made public very early on. One thing that kind of wasn't made public until just a few years ago is that it is believed that up to 10 workers were actually living inside that condo across the hall from Jennifer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, Jen was not thrilled with this arrangement, and she told her mother previous, you know, to all of this, like several weeks before, that there were a few times that she would just pass by the workers and they would stop and stare at her. She had told her mom this. She had also told some of her friends this. And they had said, like, listen, if they say anything to you, if they do anything, like, make sure you tell management. But as far as her parents know, it never rose above that. And so she never brought it up to anybody else.
So no incidents. They just get quiet whenever she goes past.
And stared, yeah.
Yeah. Creepy, but not
criminal.
Yeah. Not even hinting at criminality.
Exactly, yeah. But at the end of the day, Jen was a 24-year-old woman living on her own, and, you know, she felt kind of nervous. In fact, it seems like that might have kind of been an underlying reason between that last disagreement that she had with Rob. She always told him that she felt safer with him around. So this, of course, is something that has haunted him for years because the literal worst-case scenario happened, and he wasn't there to protect her. Now, the idea of a worker at the condo complex being responsible for Jen's disappearance may be a familiar one to anyone who has been following the news recently, especially in Orlando. On September 24th, 2021, Mia Mercano, a 19-year-old college student, disappeared from the Arden Villas apartments in Orlando. She lived in an apartment there and worked part-time in the leasing office. Her body was found on October 2nd near a different apartment complex about 18 miles from her home. Police were led to her body by looking into the phone records of 27-year-old Armando Caballero, a maintenance worker at Mia's complex. These phone records showed that he had been in the area where her body was found for around 20 minutes on the day she disappeared. Orlando police's theory is that he had expressed a romantic interest in Mia, but had been rejected. They found his body on September 27th. He had died by suicide. Now, these two cases are almost certainly unrelated, but Mia's case definitely confirmed the suspicions held by a lot of people over the years that something similar had happened to Jennifer. The first major break in Jennifer's case came on January 26th, 2 days after her disappearance.
Please tell me they found her car.
That's exactly what they found.
Okay, because I'm like, this whole time I'm thinking, missing person is hard enough, but, you know, you have a missing car, that's typically an easy thing to find, and that's how you start tracking her.
Yeah, exactly. So, luckily, Jennifer Kessie was a young, beautiful white woman, and so her case was getting a ton of media coverage. And again, like I said, her father was out there pounding the pavement as well,
yeah,
trying to generate as much interest in this as possible. This actually led to a resident at the nearby Huntington-on-the-Green condominiums calling police to report that they had seen a black Chevy Malibu that matched the description of the one that Jen owned in their parking lot. Police went to check it out and confirmed that it was in fact Jen's car. They obviously searched the vehicle and did not find the items that she had left the house with, her purse, her phone, or her iPod. Though it was great for the investigation to find the car, unfortunately, not a lot of evidence came with it. According to police, there was no blood, hair samples, or DNA that they were able to get from the vehicle. Other evidence that was found around this discovery proved to be similarly frustrating. Now, against all odds, because it seems like surveillance cameras are always broken, they actually did have footage of the parking lot.
Where the car was found?
Yes.
But we don't have surveillance footage from her parking lot. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So this footage showed someone driving Jennifer's car into the parking lot, sitting inside for about 30 seconds, and then walking away. This was around noon on January 24th, the day she went missing.
And do we have a description of this person?
Well, that's the frustrating part. So instead of this surveillance camera being like a regular video camera, which shoots at 30 frames per second, this type of camera wanted to save, you know, memory space. So it actually only took a photo every 3 seconds. And when the person is captured on the camera getting out of the car and walking basically in front of the camera, there's a gate, like a wrought iron 6-foot gate between the person and the camera. And every time the camera takes a photo, the person's face is obscured by a bar on the gate.
Jesus.
Yeah.
But that gate should be a decent enough reference to get at least a height.
That's actually correct. However, that apparently didn't happen for 2 more years.
What?
Yeah. So in 2008, the FBI tried to enhance the footage, but all they were able to determine was that the person on the video was between 5'3" and 5'5" tall.
Short.
Yeah. And it was very obvious that it was not Jennifer. She was 5'8", and this person had dark hair. She had blonde hair.
Do we have a length of hair? Do we have man, woman? Do they have any suspicion one way or the other?
They could not determine if it was a man or a woman. You can see the clothes. It looked like baggy jeans and like a short sleeve t-shirt, both light colored, dark hair. And it looked like it might have been pulled back like in a ponytail, but it's kind of unclear.
No race?
No, it's black and white.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a lighter skinned person.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, other than they're not like a dark black person.
Right.
That's pretty much all you can rule out.
God, that's frustrating.
So, yeah, the fact that it took 2 years for the FBI to get involved and even try to enhance this footage could kind of tell you about the number of answers investigators got early on.
I mean, no fingerprints in the car?
No, apparently. And this wasn't released until just a few years ago, but apparently the only fingerprint that they were able to get from the car was one latent print of Jen's.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, she either keeps a really clean car.
I know. That was weird. And it's also interesting to me that there wasn't any blood or hair found. And I'll get to why toward the end, because again, a lot of information came out just recently that was not made public at the beginning. So we'll circle back to all that. 6 months after her disappearance, with the investigation going nowhere, Orlando PD assigned a new detective to the case, Detective Joel Wright. But unfortunately, other than the FBI looking at the video in 2008, like there really wasn't a whole lot of movement even after he took over. Around that time, as the 3-year anniversary of Jennifer's disappearance was approaching, he decided to take a fresh look at the case, which again, had gotten pretty cold by that point, as you can imagine. He started by re-interviewing people who had been around Jennifer's condo at the time of her disappearance. One of the people he spoke to was a former housekeeper who had worked in the complex. He showed her a photo of the unidentified person from the security camera, and she was like, oh yeah, no, I think I know who that is.
I mean, how?
Well, she told Detective Wright that the person in the footage looked like a guy named Chino, who she knew from the complex. And so I think after he showed her the photo and she was like, oh yeah, no, I think I know him, he then showed her the video because she said that the hair, the clothing, and his gait all reminded her of him.
Hmm.
And Wright had never heard of this person before. So even though he had worked at Jennifer's complex, he was apparently never interviewed at the beginning of this investigation.
Hmm.
What's incredibly frustrating about that is that not only did he work there as a maintenance worker, he lived there, and he was one of the people who had done repairs inside of Jennifer's condo the week before she disappeared.
Oh my God.
Yeah. We're not even talking about across the hall. We are talking about literally in her condo.
Ugh.
And nobody talked to him. Nobody found this out at the time. This is almost 3 years later.
So there had to have been documentation on that. right?
Of the people repairing something in her condo.
Yeah.
I would imagine that's never talked about in any of the articles that I read. But yeah, it's I just insane
wonder,
to me.
Yeah, I just wonder why that hadn't been looked into initially.
Yeah, because this whole idea of like maintenance workers and contractors, that was floating around from the very beginning. So to me, it would very much make sense to go to that manager and say, hey.
Who has been in her condo.
Right.
Let's say in the last month. And
yeah.
Then give me a list and we'll start interviewing them.
Yeah. But this guy, Chino, his name had never come up.
Interesting.
And there were other people in her apartment that I don't know their names, but it just said he was one of several people who were fixing something in her apartment. Oh, and even worse, as Detective Wright was digging into this, he also found an anonymous crime line tip from the first week of the investigation that suggested that Chino may be involved.
What the hell?
Yeah. So I don't think it's a major spoiler alert to say that over the past 16 years, the Kesey family has not been a huge fan of the Orlando PD.
Yeah.
Luckily, Wright was able to track Chino down pretty easily as he was in prison serving time for a statutory rape charge.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So Wright ended up interviewing him in March of 2009, and Chino admitted he worked in Jennifer's condo. However, he denied having anything to do with her abduction and said he had no idea what happened to her.
And did the detective confront him about that possibly being him driving her car?
I don't know. What I do know is that Chino agreed to take a polygraph test.
Okay.
And he passed.
Doesn't mean a whole lot.
Right, exactly. But it means a lot in that the Chino lead just pretty much seems to have died at that point.
Yeah.
Detective Wright resigned from the department a year later in 2010, and Jennifer's case went stagnant once again and stayed that way for years.
Do we know why he resigned?
Nope.
When you make it to a detective level, like, that's...
You don't want to resign from that.
Well, yeah. It says that you've been on the force for a while.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, cops retire as cops.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they have to quit.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be curious as to why he resigned.
Now, it could be something as simple as he resigned to take a position in another department.
Absolutely.
Another yes. police department.
Sure.
I don't know. But as we'll find out later, that affected the case greatly. So the Chino interview was 2009. He resigns in 2010. Fast forward to 2016. After Jennifer Kesey has been missing for 10 years, she was declared dead by the state of Florida. And this, of course, was devastating for her family. They had accepted by that point that Jennifer was no longer alive, but they had not and would not give up the fight to find her.
So if she's declared deceased, what does that do for her case as far as the police are concerned?
Oh, nothing, apparently.
So they're not.
Yeah, I don't know if that was just done.
This or...
Yeah, I don't know if that was just done for like legal reasons, because that was in the Cherry Mahan case that we covered
right.
in season one.
Yeah.
Her mother eventually had her declared deceased. So just again, for estate purposes,
just
to free up some money and things like that. So it could have been something along those lines. But I don't think it had anything to do with the investigation.
But did it change the investigation at all?
No, because there wasn't one. In 2018, so 2 years after this, the Kesey family sued the Orlando Police Department for her case files.
Good.
Yeah. They ended up reaching a settlement and had to pay $18,000 to get the documents.
What? Why?
So I don't know all the details of the settlement, but this is actually pretty common when it comes to things like this, not so much in like court cases, but when you put in a FOIA request, which is the Freedom of Information Act, the agency that you're requesting the files from will charge you for the manpower that it takes to get the information together if they are making
copies of things. They will charge you for the paper. Like, they will do that. And so different governmental bodies will charge different amounts for these things. And so Orlando PD's price was $18,000, which,
God. So, yeah. I mean, you have to think, like, they've got to be charging somebody's salary.
Yeah, basically.
Who to copy, to photocopy the records.
Oh, except it turns out it wasn't even photocopied. I found out in a much later article that it was given to them all electronically.
So they're paying somebody's salary
to put a folder on a thumb drive, basically. Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So in 2019, when they reached the settlement and paid their $18,000 in return, they received more than 16,000 pages of documents and nearly 70 hours of audio and video recordings. Part of the settlement was also that the Orlando PD would no longer lead the investigation.
So who did they give the investigation to then?
Nobody.
So, okay. I'm sorry.
It honestly seems like the Orlando Police Department was like, give me my money. Here's your shit. Don't talk to me anymore.
What I'm confused about. So, okay. I get it. It's a cold case, but she was declared dead.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it make sense if she is dead and dead under suspicious circumstances, given that she went missing and you found her car and never found any of her items? Wouldn't it make sense to pass that on to a homicide detective then, instead of just like shelving the case?
I mean, one would think, but that is not what happened. And once they got all of these documents, they really, really found out that that was not what happened. Because along with this, the Kessie family also hired former federal agent and private investigator Mike Toretta, who started digging into these files and doing his own investigation. As soon as he did, he started finding new information, or at least information that hadn't been made public. And it sounds like some of it is information that the Kessie family also was not aware of. And it's worth noting that to answer your question about, hey, why didn't they give it to a homicide detective? Why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? What they found is that no reports or documents had been put in the file after 2010, which, if you remember, is the year that Detective Wright resigned. So it sounds like after he resigned, the case literally went to no one.
How does that happen?
I have no idea. And so it's interesting. So much like Kiara Coles' case from last week, that case was suspended. And apparently so is Jennifer's, except no one bothered to mention it. Like, I don't want to give the Chicago PD of all organizations like any praise, but at least they had the decency to like say they weren't doing shit on her case.
I was dumbfounded last week. I'm dumbfounded this week. I didn't think that that was a thing. Look, I mean, like, granted, I am not a detective.
Right.
And I have never worked investigations on a law enforcement scale, but I was a social worker and I had a caseload and my official title was investigator. So I had a manager and I met weekly with the manager,
mm-hmm.
and we would talk about the cases. Again, this isn't, missing persons. It's not a law enforcement investigation, but it's a social worker investigation. I had to review every case that I had with my manager weekly.
Right. And I imagine, more importantly, when you left that position, they didn't just take all your cases and like throw them in the trash.
No, I had to either transfer or close my cases before I left. And the ones that I couldn't complete in time, the manager, my boss, took them and she became the caseworker. You're talking about going back to 2003,
mm-hmm.
when I was doing that. So, I mean, like, I had case folders that were like 3 or 4 inches thick, like of actual paper dating back to whenever, along with all of the computerized items that were pertaining to the case. If that was the case back in 2003, when I was a social worker, I don't understand how this can happen in 2010 in law enforcement.
Yeah. With the very high profile case.
Yeah. I'm completely dumbfounded. Last episode and this episode, I'm dumbfounded.
Now, I'm not sure if this information, this next thing that I'm going to talk about, came from the police reports or from his own investigation. But soon after taking the case, Toretto learned that after Jennifer disappeared, a witness had seen someone dumping a rolled up carpet into a lake about 12 miles from Jennifer's condo. Now, this struck Toretto, obviously, because it's incredibly creepy, but also because the work that was being done in the condo across the hall from Jen included installing carpet. This tip was very much taken seriously, not only by Toretta and the Kesey family, but by law enforcement, though not the Orlando PD. In November of 2019, members of the Orange County Sheriff's Office went to the lake with a dive team and searched. So they, again, searched for, I believe, 2 days, but unfortunately did not find anything. Toretta still believes this lead is important, though, telling CBS News, quote, "Until we can find that carpet and see what's in it, we need to follow up on that particular lead," end quote. Also in the police report were photos of Jennifer's car, which would be expected. But what the family didn't know is that these photos actually offered a clue as to what happened that morning. So Jennifer's car was black and it was a little dirty. And as you know, like, black cars really show dirt.
Yep.
So there were streaks and marks in the dirt on the hood of the car. These marks were described in the corresponding police report this way, quote, "While observing the front of the victim's vehicle, these detectives observed what appeared to have been someone being pushed across the head of the vehicle," end quote. And we'll have this picture up. This was just released in 2019, 2020, pretty recently. And you can kind of see, so if you're facing the hood of the car, what you see is basically a large smudge on the right-hand side, which could be from like a body,
right,
you know, a person, yeah, being thrown there. And then on the left, you see skinny lines as if somebody had their fingers dragged on there across. It was being dragged off of the hood of the car. The report also said that there was a large boot print near the gas pedal.
So this, what we had originally thought was a rather clean car because they couldn't, quote unquote, didn't get anything from the car other than a latent fingerprint of hers, is not quite as clean as we had thought.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because that whole thing about the latent print, that was not something that was made public then. That was made public along with this. So the story back then was that they didn't get anything from the car.
Right. But so we've got a boot print,
mm-hmm,
that we at least have a picture of. I mean, so this person, whoever did this, was not super careful about cleaning up after himself or herself. So why weren't things investigated a little bit further?
I don't know. It really concerns me. Like, having seen that there was evidence of a struggle on the hood of the car, that there was this boot print, it really does make me wonder, like, was there really nothing to be found of forensic value in that car?
Right.
Or was it not searched well enough,
right,
to find anything of forensic value?
Right. I mean, a boot print, right?
Yeah.
So she's a financial manager.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's not hers. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and even if they thought maybe it was hers, a real easy way to do that is to go back and look at her shoes.
Right.
You know, and there's so much information that you can get from a boot print.
Yeah.
And I understand it's probably not a full boot print, so it's not like you can be like, oh, that's like an Adidas size, whatever.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Not that Adidas,
yeah,
makes boots, but you know what my point is.
Right. Yeah, you can't get that much information of it. Like, what all it really told them was that there was
somebody else was driving, yeah, the car. Yeah. I mean, all of this evidence, yes, it's not something that you can convict anybody on, but it's certainly leading you in a direction, and that maybe they should have taken this investigation a tad bit more serious.
Well, and that's, but that's not even the problem. They did take it very seriously. I think the problem is that, and this is what Drew Kessy is alleging, is that they were just incompetent. I don't think, because often, listen, we have covered a lot of cases that law enforcement does not investigate well because they don't take it seriously. I don't think that was the particular problem in this case.
But do you think maybe they weren't taking certain steps because they were treating it as a quote-unquote missing person and not a homicide?
I don't.
A potential homicide.
I don't. I honestly don't, because I think that very early on, they did not have that whole thing that we often see. It was like, oh, maybe she walked away and started a new life. Like, that was never a thing in this. You know, they cleared her family very quickly. Like, they, from very close to the beginning of this investigation, treated it as an abduction.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you now. I mean, I just, now it makes me question what steps they took to find any evidence in the car.
Well, exactly. And yeah, that's my concern. And again, I mean, go back to 2009 when Detective Wright was like, oh, wait, Chino, what? Who's this? I mean, that in and of itself.
Yeah, it says it.
It really does. I mean, somebody who's working inside of her condo like that. Okay, Rob's the first person you interview. Her family. That's number two. Number three.
Who's been inside of her apartment or condo recently?
Yeah.
Damn.
And even though there was nearly 70 hours of audio and visual material in that case file, you know, a lot of interviews, and these interviews are recorded, Chino was not interviewed. And if he wasn't interviewed, I have to think that maybe none of the other people who were working in her condo were interviewed. And there's even a little bit more. So recently, Fox News actually did an 11-part podcast about Jennifer's case. And during that reporting, an anonymous witness came forward to say that they actually witnessed Jennifer's car being driven out of the parking lot erratically that morning, January 24th, 2006, almost as if somebody was fighting over the steering wheel. After looking at all of the documents and going through all of the recordings, as well as conducting his own investigation, Michael Toretta believes that the construction workers who were staying in the condo across the hall from Jennifer hold the key to this investigation. As of this recording, the 16-year anniversary of Jennifer's abduction has just passed. Though he still keeps in contact with the Kessy family, Jennifer's boyfriend Rob eventually married and had two children. At the time of Jennifer's disappearance, her little brother Logan was supposed to move to California with his girlfriend. He scrapped those plans to stay in Florida and help search for his sister. Eventually, though, Drew and Joyce encouraged him to go live his life. They wanted him to travel and have a career. And so he did, and eventually he married and had children himself. Joyce and Drew Kessy remain in Florida and are still actively searching for their daughter. Drew says that they are doing this investigation completely on their own and that no law enforcement agency is currently involved. He has a GoFundMe for search contributions that we'll link in our show notes and on our blog. In late 2021, he told reporters that they are still getting leads and he's feeling confident that he will find answers about his daughter's fate. Drew told News 6 Orlando during the 2019 lake search, quote, Joyce, Logan, and I love Jennifer. Joyce and I created her. She is our child. Ultimately, I am responsible for finding my child. End quote. Jennifer Kessy has been missing from Orlando, Florida since January 24th, 2006. She is a white female, and at the time of her disappearance, she was 5'8" and 125 pounds with blonde hair and green eyes. She has a birthmark on the middle finger of her left hand, a faded strawberry birthmark on her ribs, surgical scars on the inside of her left elbow, and a shamrock tattoo in her left buttock. Jennifer was 24 when she went missing. She would be 40 today. Anyone with information on Jennifer's disappearance is asked to call the Kesey Family Tip Line at 941-201-4009. You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos, at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook, and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Conan Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Conan Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!